equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Etnair, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. I've got a blog called Relocalizing Vermont. You can find that at the Vermont Commons website. That's vtcommons.org/blog. And there are a lot of people who blog there. Look for the posts that begin Relocalizing Vermont. And the audio of this show and Travin's shows on Tuesdays are at the Equal Time Radio website, www.equaltimeradio.com. So if your friends missed today's show and you want them to hear it, tell them to go to equaltimeradio.com. They can either stream it on their computer or download it and listen to it at their leisure. And we do have a great show coming up today. You may want to be alerting your friends to it. In the first half of the show, we'll be talking with Carl Russell of Earthwise Farm and Forestry in Bethel. He farms and logs with oxen and horses. We'll ask him why he uses such ancient technology in the 21st century, what he likes about it. The second half of the show, we'll be talking about the Village Building Convergence. It's a community-wide celebration in Montpelier of sustainable living and practical homesteading skills. And it's all put together with visions of a more resilient local community. That's starting off this next Saturday in Montpelier and going for over a week. Organizer Ben Graham will be with us, along with gourmet mushroom gardener Alyssa White. They're going to explain why they're celebrating and how they're celebrating and what's coming up in the Village Building Convergence. But first, everybody's talking about healthcare, and so will we. This morning, Paul Beaudry, if you were listening to True North between 11 and 12, played a little of a 1961 talk by Ronald Reagan. And I've got to say, I was surprised that he would want to bring that up. At the time, Ronald Reagan was employed by the AMA, the American Medical Association, as part of Operation Coffee Cup, to oppose Medicare. Ronald Reagan was saying that Medicare would lead to totalitarianism. You think I exaggerate? That's pretty much what he was saying. Former Vermont Governor Madeline Cunin lived through Operation Coffee Cup, and here's what she has to say about that time. This is from an article that was published in the Huffington Post, and actually that article was adapted from a radio commentary. So from radio to print to back to radio. She said, amongst other things, "Doctors' wives, which I was at the time, were expected to be a part of the AMA auxiliary. We were recruited to spread the word about the evils of socialized medicine. They did not ask us to disrupt town meetings. Instead, we were asked to hold teas in our neighborhoods and play a record made by Ronald Reagan. The closing words warned that if Medicare and Medicaid were passed, according to Reagan's sonorous voice, in your sunset years, you will be able to tell your children and grandchildren what life was like when men were free." In other words, Medicare, this is me again, Carl, if Medicare and Medicaid were passed, your children and grandchildren will be living in totalitarianism. Cunin continues, "Ronald Reagan turned out to be wrong. Most of us are so happy in our sunset years to have access to Medicare, and yes, we are still free. The lesson here is simple. The hysterical exaggerations that are being blasted from the airwaves are almost identical to what we heard then. They did not triumph then, and they must not be allowed to drown out the voices of reason and common sense today." So anybody who is holding up Ronald Reagan in 1961 as a model for good discourse about health care is saying you shouldn't have Medicare. If you don't have money to pay for your medical care, you're over 65, you should not be covered by medical care. But don't listen to them. Medicare is very popular. We're going to keep it, and we're going to expand in it. We're now engaged in a great debate about health care. Barack Obama described the stakes well the other day when he said, "No one in America should go broke because they get sick." Here on Equal Time, we're going to hear, and this is, goes across the hosts, we're going to hear from some Vermonters about how the current system serves them and how they'd like it to change. I put together some excerpts from testimony that was held 4 years ago when Vermont was just gearing up to reform our healthcare system. That reform effort didn't amount to much in the end. Catamount was created, a little tinkering around the edges. The testimony we'll hear is from a joint hearing of Vermont's Health and Welfare Committee of the Senate and the House Healthcare Committee. This is held in March 2005. Our healthcare system has changed some since then, but it's mostly, as I said, been tinkering around the edges, so I expect most of these stories would be equally relevant today. The first Vermonter to testify was Ron Ruloff.
My name is Ron Ruloff, semi-retired in Burlington. I produce a show on VCAM. What I would like to relate is my experiences with medical privacy and with attempting to get emergency dental care. My teeth are in terrible shape. I had a toothache that kept me awake the entire night. I wanted to avoid the community health center in Burlington because of previous problems with it. They will say it's free, but it's not free. They give you a piece of paper to sign where you're supposed to take responsibility for payment. Be that as it may, I went to the emergency room, and the only thing they offered was a shot of Novocaine, and then they said, we're going to send you over to Spectrum. Spectrum is for people under 21. So I look like I should be going to Spectrum or the community health center. Should I be going there? Well, I went there, finally. And I was told that I had to go through welfare. I don't qualify for welfare, never have qualified for welfare, and went through a lot of rigmarole. Well, I have this toothache, remember. And finally, they made an appointment for me, and I found out that I had to discuss my entire finances to put on a sliding scale in front of the entire waiting room. This I objected to. I said, this could be done, since I am on VHAP, simply by coding the income that you have and then pricing it according to that type of arrangement. I refused to give them my pay information. Dr. John Furnham came out, he's director of the clinic, and he said, well, we do the best we can to assure medical privacy, but that's all we're going to do. And if you don't like it, you don't have to use this facility. And in fact, you'd rather that you didn't. I had to resolve the toothache problem someplace else. There's a lot of detail to this. I only have a few minutes to speak here. But what I find is that they use, first of all, your Social Security number. And they will ask you, what is your Social Security number, in front of 15 people. This has no regards for anyone's privacy. If you want identity theft, the Attorney General did a hearing on that. This is an ample, perfect opportunity for a computer tape to give the Social Security numbers of everyone in Vermont to whoever wants them. Thank you.
That was Ron Ruloff. He was testifying before the Senate Health and Welfare Committee and the House Health and Health Committee in March of 2005. It was a joint hearing here on Equal Time. We'll be hearing more of these stories from ordinary Vermonters as they were told in March 2005, and we'll probably get some updated stories as well. Now to the main theme of the first half of our show. Animal power. Carl Russell from Earthwise Farm and Forestry in Bethel is on the line. Carl, welcome back to Equal Time. Tell us on this hot August day how you're using horses and oxen in your farming and logging.
Well, we have a piece of property here in Bethel, Vermont that is about 150 acres and mostly forested at this point. We have other open land where we raise cattle, a couple of dairy cows and stuff. Where we keep the land open for pasture for not only the dairy cows, but for our horses and for our steers. So we have a fairly diversified enterprise. And the way I'm using the horses, right now I've got a pair of steers that I haven't been using much, but I use them, when I do use them, I use them fairly well interchanged with the horsepower. But I'm using the horses for plowing the land where we raise vegetables. We do some garlic and potatoes and a few crops that we sell for market, as well as the vegetables we raise for ourselves. And I do all the plowing and cultivating on those small lots. And I also use them for moving any of the manure or compost that we move around. I use them a lot in the woods. That's my training is as a forester, and most of what I've used my draft animals for over the years for part of my career is to as a horse logger or animal powered timber harvester. And so on our most of our property, that's what I'm doing most of the time with them, is getting out logs, opening up areas for future management, producing firewood. And right now we've undertaken a overstory removal on a plantation of white pine, red pine, and Norway spruce that my grandfather planted in 1956. It was 30 acres of open land that he didn't foresee himself or anybody in the family at that time doing anything more with it for agricultural purposes. So rather than letting it grow up to pioneer species, he planted it. And I've been managing those plantations for a little over, well, almost 30 years, actually. And now they are in a stage where I would need to be doing regeneration cuts in there, and we've decided that we're going to clear that land and return it to, or to turn it into a pasture and cropland use. So that's actually a fairly long, probably over the next 10 years, but I'm going to be doing that, all of that with animals, with the horses doing the harvesting there.
Boy, if you got some diesel-powered equipment, and if you got some diesel-powered equipment in there, Carl, you could probably get all those trees off of there right this year.
Yeah, we could. But then, you know, one of the things that comes into the equation a lot is when you start talking about equipment like tractors and bulldozers or any type of piece of machinery, it adds cost. And one of the reasons why I'm so attracted to animal power, which I've been using them since 1986 exclusively, is that the daily cost per animal is about $3. That includes the purchase price of the animal and equipment that I've amortized over the lifespan, not only of the equipment of the animals, but about $3 per head per day year-round. And I can use that for a variety of harvesting, and I don't have to be specifically limited to some narrow range designated by an engineer that's developed a piece of equipment.
Right.
And it is a lot less upkeep in terms of the financial input. And so, although you could get the land cleared in a much much quicker, it would cost me. Basically, I have a much higher margin of return by doing it myself with animals that I've purchased at a fairly low price and basically train them to do what I want them to do. I've invested, the value that they represent now is all based on time that I've invested in them, and the work that I get done with them is all based on my capability and ingenuity and so forth. And that's to me is a place of value that is not typically talked about or promoted. We're much more oriented toward proficiency and the ease of an operation, and, you know, getting it done quicker. It actually leads me into a discussion. I was thinking this morning a little bit more about this, and I could go out today. Well, maybe I couldn't go out right today, but a person could go out and get $500,000 in debt on equipment and livestock, and could become considered a farmer. However, or a timber harvester. However, the upkeep, the maintenance, the fuel, the insurance, the labor costs of keeping the equipment running at an optimum rate, all of these things add up, and the size of the operation is very attractive to people in a modern sense. People see these larger or medium to large size operations as being the standard, but the margin is used up by a fairly high cost of operation. Whereas if you use draft animals, yes, you your production is very low. Your cash flow is substantially less, but you have the opportunity to take more of it. And to me, it's always been about dollars in versus dollars out. And over the years, I've never, as much as I've struggled to make money from time to time, I've never looked at my draft animals and said, oh, my God, I can't afford to keep you around.
Mm. We're talking with Carl Russell. He farms in Bethel at Earthwise Farm and Forestry. He uses draft horses and oxen in the farming. This is Equal Time, and I'm Carl Etnayer. So what is the appropriate scale for draft power? David Klein, who's been invited to be the keynote speaker at your annual event, the Animal Powered Field Days, coming up in October, wrote an essay in the program for that, saying, when considering horses for farming, one has to think in terms of scale. Horses aren't a very viable option on a 1,000-acre corn or soybean farm, while at the same time, 150-horsepower tractor, just because it has air conditioning and stereo, is not a good choice to clip pastures and plow the garden on a small, diversified farm. You have, I think you said, about 150 acres. Is that the right size for four animals, or do you find yourself doing contract work on other farms and forests?
Well, I think that the 150 acres is probably more than I can handle by myself. But being also of a modern cloth, cut from modern cloth, I have ambitions beyond my own land and trying. You know, I do contract work as a result of my forestry degree and just interest in providing services to other people. So I'm constantly not caught up with everything that I need to be doing on my own land. But 150 acres is certainly a piece of land, especially if a portion of it is in woodland, is something that is entirely doable with draft animals. I was just thinking about the idea of the scale and clipping pastures. One thing that we purchased this year was a DR tow-behind brush hog. It's got its own power unit on it. It's a 13-horsepower unit, and it's 42-inch cut. And I'm actually brush hogging all of my fields now that we're pasturing with our animals that we're pasturing. I'm going around and clipping all the weeds that they haven't eaten and so forth. And I'm able, with this mower, to take on all kinds of brush that I wouldn't have been able to do with my horse-drawn sickle bar mower. It's a substantial investment of well over $2,000, but if I look at the number of hours that I'll put in this year brush hogging and were to hire somebody to do that for me, we'd pretty well have paid for this machine.
Hmm.
And it really, it gives me one more chore that I can do with the horses, and it does, it's sort of a melding of the modern and the so-called archaic technology of draft animals.
Hmm. Well, in your lifetime, or at least in the time that you've been working with draft animals, Carl Russell, since 1986, have you seen developments in the technology of draft animals or the training techniques, or is this something that's like the violin, that people reached perfection with the technology hundreds of years ago and they just keep making the same thing?
Well, there's certain things like the physical reality of the way that the horse or the ox works that was pretty well captured a long time ago in terms of the angle of draft. In other words, the height that the point of where the point at which the animals pull against their shoulder or their neck is pretty much limited by physics. And so there hasn't been a great deal of improvement in terms of the actual technology used to harness the animals. A lot of the issues around animal care, feeding, nutrition, they've been tweaking some of that stuff, when they find dietary supplements like kelp and so forth. It can really help an animal be more fit, possibly, than if you just had them out on pasture 100% of the time.
Eating seaweed helps animals?
What's that?
Eating seaweed helps horses and oxen?
Oh, it's full of all kinds of great stuff, basic fundamental minerals and iodine, and yeah, it's a great supplement.
Huh.
Yeah, but anyway, those are the. I mean, there are things like that don't necessarily change the animal or don't necessarily improve it, but they do help us in terms of health care and keeping the animals fit. But more so, the things that have been changing are, some of the more modern fabricating capabilities have brought hydraulic accumulators to four carts so that every time the wheel goes around, it compresses a cylinder and it adds pressure to a hydraulic cylinder so that there can be some lifting mechanism on the back of a cart so that a farmer could use a three-point hitch plow or something like that behind his horses, which is different than the original John Deere plows. And but what we do, there are, and melding with machinery, motorized four carts and so forth are the types of things like I described before. But what we find is that the draft animals really are just as effective as they ever were. I mean, in comparison with a 150 horsepower tractor, obviously we already realize that they're not going to compete that way. But if you use a 150-year-old walking plow, it's going to be just as effective behind the horses as it was then. And as you know, some people may say, "Well, that isn't very effective," but it is very effective at that scale, and that may be more along the lines of an acre a day as opposed to 20 acres a day or 50 acres a day with a large tractor.
So plowing is about an acre a day with draft animals.
Yeah, as a rule, none of these things have rules, but
sure.
There are rules of thumb, I guess, and
yeah.
It depends on, obviously, the soil, whether or not it's been plowed before, whether or not you've got the plow adjusted correctly, the heft of the soil and everything, but yeah.
What you ate for breakfast that morning.
Yeah, whether or not the kids have to go to Taekwondo. Yeah.
Right, okay. Well, what about the age of farmers in Vermont who work with draft animals? The average age of a Vermont farmer is around 56, 57 years old, according to the last census figures. Is it younger, older, about the same for those of you who work with draft animals?
Oh, I would have to say that I think it's probably younger, because there is a lot more. I know a lot of young people who are very interested in using draft animals, and there are a lot of young people interested in farming as well, but a lot of the draft animals lend themselves quite well to small-scale farming. A lot of, like at the Green Mountain College down in Pulteney, they have a draft animal and sustainable agricultural program. And they're working on small market garden scale agriculture. They're not talking about 150, 200, 500 dairy cows on a farm and 500 acres of cropland or anything. They're talking about a much smaller scale. And I think my experience is that a lot of people of the younger generation that are finding that attractive and finding draft animals as an attractive addition to that.
Mm.
So I'd have to say it was younger, but I do know a lot of people, of course I'm not 56 yet, but I do know people my age that have been using them and still are. And the old timers are few and far between now. There's they're in their 80s now, and very few of them are working their horses. But there was a gap between like 1920 or 1950 to 1970, where basically the draft horse or draft animal was virtually non-existent on the farm or anywhere in the rural communities in New England. And it around the 70s, people started to get interested in using them again. During that period of time, a lot of people just dropped the reins, so to speak. And so there's a real gap between the 85-year-old guys and the people that are my age in terms of people who are doing it.
What brought it back around 1970? That was before the fuel crisis of 73. Was it just the back-to-the-land
yeah.
movement?
Well, I think part of it was, like David Klein alludes in that article, part of it is that there was a group of people who realized that farming did not have to be, and probably in some people's minds shouldn't be, an enterprise of economy of scale. Farming can be considered an art, and there's a lot of judgment and creativity associated with raising animals and raising crops and producing from that, and functioning in a natural rhythm with natural beings and natural organisms. And there are people who have recognized that and didn't actually go down that road. And I think it took 20, 25 years or so for farming to really escalate beyond a certain level of reason, and I think that people started picking up the draft animal again, and or becoming more noticeable and more attractive. Mm. And yeah, and there's a certain, you know, right now we're facing the peak oil challenge and the transition. There's a lot of environmental pressures that we're facing, and a lot of people are talking about. There's more gardens being planted now. Well, you know, everybody knows that once you start growing a garden, you end up with surplus, and so the small scale agriculture is becoming much more of an item of discussion as a way to sustain our families and our communities. And along with that, if you have an organism that's being supported by your small scale farming enterprise that you can at the same time harness and use to augment your own physical power without having to go and possibly spend lots and lots of money on fuel, or certainly not being hamstringed by the fact you can't find fuel, you can have a draft animal that can provide some sustainability to your enterprise.
Carl Russell, I'm pleased you found a good economic niche for your draft animals, and you are working on teaching what other people need to know to people who want to learn about it. And we'll talk with you again in a couple months, just before your big shindig Animal Power Field Days in October. So Carl Russell from Earthwise Farm and Forestry in Bethel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking with Alyssa White about backyard gourmet mushroom gardening, one of the mini workshops that will be held in Montpelier at the Village Building Convergence starting on Saturday this weekend, going for a week, and with organizer Ben Graham. In just a minute, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettner, your Monday host, and for the rest of the show, we're going to be talking about Village Building Convergence, which starts up in Montpelier on Saturday, the 22nd of August, and runs through August 30th, almost the end of the month. With us here today are one of the organizers of the event, Ben Graham from Plainfield. Ben, welcome to the show. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we also have one of the presenters at the Village Building Convergence, Alyssa White, on the line. We don't have Alyssa White on the line anymore, but we'll get her back. So while we're waiting to get her back, Ben, why don't you tell us about the Convergence, what it is, why you chose to put it together?
Yeah, thanks, Carl. Well, it's really exciting, and it's turned out to be quite an event, much more than we had even hoped for. And the idea was, there's really a lot of interest now in the Central Vermont area in learning, relearning, reskilling around sustainable living, ways to do things that we've been doing, kind of taken for granted, using a lot of...
Hello, Ben. We seem to have lost Ben there, but I think we got Alyssa on the line in the meantime. Hello,
Hi,
Alyssa. Yes. Welcome to the show, Alyssa White.
Thank Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard Ben's introduction there, but he was saying that reskilling is one of the big interests in this area, learning skills that have been forgotten or just in the hands of just a few people like Carl Russell from Earthwise Farm and Forestry, who we're talking to in the first part of this show. And I suppose it's probably fair to say that growing mushrooms in your backyard is something that not a lot of people have skills for. I'm not sure they ever have.
You know, I think people have been growing mushrooms in their backyards in Asia for a really long time, but it's a rarity in Vermont, certainly.
Okay. So it's more a skill importation than a reskilling for Vermont.
You might say that. You might say that.
Okay. Well, the title of your workshop, Backyard Gourmet Mushroom Gardening, that sounds just luscious. Tell us about what you're planning to cover.
You know, I'd like to introduce folks to some really simple, accessible methods to growing mushrooms in their gardens, which is, you know, adding mushroom to the garden is a great idea. They're nutritious and medicinal, and they also increase nutrient cycling in the garden, build organic matter. There are certainly some more high-tech ways to grow mushrooms in your own space, but I'm going to show some simple sheet mulching methods that you can plant other veggies into, and some log culture, and also maybe some really simple solar technology for demonstrating how to, like, sterilize a substrate before you inoculate it with mushrooms. Hope that's not too technical.
Mm-hmm. Sterilize the substrate so that you get the mushrooms that you want in.
Yeah, so when we grow mushrooms, we're feeding them kind of like dead plant stuff or wood chips. And if we can sterilize it ahead of time, we get a better chance that the mushrooms are going to take over the ones that we want rather than maybe something that was wild.
Right, so substrate is a fancy word for sawdust or wood chips or whatever you happen
exactly
to be growing them on.
Thanks, Carl. Yep.
And do you expect your workshop to be oriented towards homestead-style mushroom growing, or do you expect to be able to teach people how to grow enough in their backyard for sale?
Oh, well, certainly these methods are, you know, for the home gardener, but if somebody wanted to cultivate a lot of them with these methods, they could sell them. I don't know many folks in Vermont that are doing that. It's certainly an untapped niche.
Hmm.
I think the log culture has a great potential for being saleable. I know Ben Falk is doing that in Moortown. He's growing shiitake and oyster on log, and I imagine that he'll have enough for sale in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I suppose it all depends on how big your backyard is, but I've seen his log culture, and it doesn't take up very much space. He's got a big backyard. He's on 10 acres or something like that, but it doesn't take up very much space. I'd say most people in the city could fit in the same number of logs that he has. So one of the things that impressed me when I visited Ben Falk's homestead was that he was growing mushrooms in the wood chips that he was keeping under the fruit trees, and thereby he was mulching the fruit trees at the same time that he was growing mushrooms, and he showed us a mushroom that was fruiting. It was shooting up at its what we call a mushroom, and he just broke it off and took part of it over to another fruit tree that he said didn't have any of that sort of mushroom, and put it down and said, okay, now I've just transplanted it over here, it'll grow here now. Is it that simple?
It can be that simple, certainly, yes. Ben's mushrooms are great. I think mulching fruit trees with inoculated, you know, spores is a great idea.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's the little part that's, the mushroom is actually just the fruiting body of the fungus, and the little part that it attaches to underneath in the soil is called mycelium, and it's this, like, network that runs through all of the mulch and into the soil, and it's that part is really easy to take from and put in a new space and hope that it starts to grow.
Hmm. So we're talking with Alyssa White. She is one of the presenters at the Village Building Convergence coming up in the Montpelier area starting on Saturday. She'll be talking about backyard gourmet mushroom gardening. And I think we also have on the line Ben Graham, one of the organizers again. Alyssa, would it be possible for you to go to another phone where we don't hear so many people in the background while we're talking with Ben?
Sure. Yeah, I'll call you back shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Hello again, Ben.
Hi, Carl.
So,
made it back.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. So, we just heard the very beginning of your story of what the Village Building Convergence is all about. So, maybe you could just start over from the beginning.
Sure. So, it's really an extravaganza of events such as the one that Alyssa was describing that she's going to be leading around mushrooms. And other skills and ways that we are creating sustainable culture in the face of these different energy and peak oil situations. And what's really kind of different, I think, about this event is that we're doing it within a context of building community in a celebratory way. So we're going to be marking throughout the week, especially at the beginning and in the end, kind of celebrations where everybody comes together and we acknowledge that, you know, this is really quite a task that we're undertaking. This isn't just a simple kind of let's tweak things here and there. We have to recognize that we're going through some big structural changes, and it's important for us to really connect in deeper ways and, kind of acknowledge some of the challenges that we're going to come up against. We're going to have to work with each other more. We're going to be rubbing shoulders. Our edges are going to be getting rounded, as we can see within the healthcare debate. And if we can do this in a way that we are acknowledging that we're doing it together and realize that we can have fun doing this, this can be an enjoyable thing. You know, work is not something that we typically look forward to, but some of the things that we're learning how to do, working with animals and plants and working in the soil, it can be really a wonderful experience. And the more that we get together and experience that together, I think, the easier this whole big transition is going to be.
So extravaganza and celebrations, I like that. That sounds fun. And then we also have a lot of good information being exchanged. And Alyssa White, you're back with us now?
Yeah.
Hey, welcome back. Sounds very quiet. So you're going to be teaching yours on Monday, the 24th of August, from 4 to 5:30 p.m. at a place called 190 Main Street in Montpelier. What is that building?
I'm not actually sure yet. Somebody else set that up for me.
Okay. Ben Graham, do you know what building that is?
190 Main Street. I'm not exactly sure either.
Okay. Well, we'll find out.
I think it's the house.
Okay.
Is the leader for that. And there's going to be a few workshops that are held at that, including some presentations by Emma Melvin.
Mm-hmm.
Who is leading a tour of rain gardens around the city, and she's also going to be giving a presentation on kind of the basics of rain gardens and low-impact development.
Hmm. Well, 190 Main Street would be somewhere towards the roundabout from downtown, but not past
exactly.
The roundabout, I'm thinking.
That's right.
Okay, and let me see, Alyssa. Why don't we let you go and get back to your time in New Hampshire? Thanks so much for joining us. Any final words on mushroom gardening that you'd like to leave us with?
Oh, it's so easy. It's worth doing it. I hope to see a lot of folks there.
Okay,
I'm excited, and I really want to share that with everyone.
And will people walk away with both knowledge, and will they be able to buy the equipment or the spawn or anything at your workshop?
I'll definitely have plenty of spawn to share with folks that come.
Very good. Well, Alyssa White.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carl.
Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
Okay. Yep, bye.
And again, Alyssa White's workshop is Monday, the 24th of August, so a week from today, and it's 4 to 5:30 p.m. at 190 Main Street in Montpelier. We'll be talking more with Ben Graham about the Village Building Convergence, why they're doing it, what else is happening there, right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettinger. We're talking about the Village Building Convergence coming up in the Montpelier area starting on Saturday and running for a little over a week. And our guest to talk about the convergence is Ben Graham. I should confess that Ben invited me to give one of the talks at the Convergence on Friday of next week. I'll be talking at the Montpelier Grange about the way of two wheels. I offered to talk about bicycling, and Ben gave me this very Zen-like title, so I'll have to figure out an appropriate Zen-like talk. But Ben, there's a lot more going on besides that.
That's right, Carl. Just to key people into where to find out about all of the information, people might have started to see posters out and about town with Village Building Convergence on the top. It's kind of a deep tan color. And it has the schedule on those posters, and it has all of the times and the names of the workshops and the locations. You know, this is a completely volunteer, grassroots-run event, so there's not, we don't have, there's not professionals running this, even though it's going to seem like it, because there's just a lot of really amazing stuff. We have this great banner hung in front of the Montpelier City Hall. But people can find out up-to-date information by going online to villageconvergencevt.org.
That's Village. I'm going to give that again. That's villageconvergencevt.org. And we'll have that on our website probably tomorrow when the audio from this show gets posted.
Yeah, and people can find more details. There will be a downloadable program that will be coming out soon, and that will be available in area businesses around Montpelier. So we're going to be coming out with a little bit more detail about what each of the events is about and what to expect. All of the events are free, except I think for two of them. So it's really accessible to everyone. Most of the events are right around town. They're being held primarily at the Montpelier Grange, where you're going to be giving your talk, the Kellogg-Hubbard Library, the Trinity Church. We're going to have our opening and closing celebrations at the Lamb Abbey. And so all of these are easily walkable or bikeable from Montpelier. And so we really wanted to create that centralized atmosphere.
And I was saying earlier in the show that everything is happening in Montpelier, but that's not quite correct. As you said, most of the things are in Montpelier, but Jamie Weiner is going to be teaching berry beer making out at Kent's Hill in Maple Corner, and Fred Chayette will be teaching about vino, which I assume is a winemaking workshop.
That's right.
And that's in Worcester. And
in Worcester.
Yep. And Nico Rubin, one of his workshops is going to be in town, and another one's going to be out at East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield on fruit and nut tree propagation, which is one that I want to reserve some time for.
Yeah, and there's also going to be one of the events that has kind of fallen under the umbrella of the Village Building Convergence is a solar hot water workshop in Marshfield Village, which is being put on by the joint collaboration of the Marshfield, Plainfield, East Montpelier Town Energy Committees. And that's going to be on Saturday 29th, and there's going to be several vendors from the area, specifically businesses that specialize in hot water, solar hot water installations.
And then,
so there is going to be a smattering of events that are going to be in the general area.
Mm.
But most of them are going to be focused in town in Montpelier.
Let's talk about the opening and closing celebrations before we run out of time here.
Sure.
The opening is on Saturday.
That's right. It's coming right up. It's going to be Saturday, and we're going to be kicking that off with a presentation by Carolyn Baker, who is the author of several books, including her latest called Sacred Demise, and she's going to be kind of kicking off the celebration along with one of the organizers of the Transition Worcester initiative Fern Lickfield, who's going to be giving the invocation. That is going to culminate in a community drum circle led by one of our drum masters and teachers from the area, Stuart Payton. And that's going to be, the community drum circle is going to start at, I believe, 8 o'clock, and I think the invocation is going to start. I'm sorry I don't have the schedule in front of me. I have so many dates and times, but I believe that's going to start between 4 and 6. And, again, people can go online to get all the specific dates.
I've got the schedule ahead in front of me. According to the poster, the opening ceremony starts 6 to 8 p.m. On Saturday. You're doing well for not having it in front of you, but I guess you've been intimately involved with this.
Yes. I'm trying to keep it all together.
And then on Sunday the 30th, there's a closing ceremony at Lamb Abbey after a discussion, How Change Happens. And then 5:30 to 7 p.m., a closing ceremony with Samba Tucada. What are Samba Tucada?
Samba Tucada is a Brazilian instrumental band, very lively. People are going to be dancing. They're mostly percussion, but just a really great band. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. And there's a whole lot of events. That second weekend is really packed with events. So make sure to get online and look at what's going to be happening where, and be sure to schedule, because unfortunately there's just too many things going on for people to get to everything that I think people are going to be interested in.
Well, Ben Graham,
last weekend,
Ben Graham, one of the organizers of the Village Building Convergence, thanks so much for putting this together, and thanks for sharing it with us today.
All right, Carl, thanks, and hope to see people out there.
VillageConvergenceVT.org is a website. That's VillageConvergenceVT.org for people who want to learn about a wide range of things and go to a celebration extravaganza in and around the Montpelier area. We also heard today that draft animals are a niche market now, but we may find ourselves going back to them in the future. It's good to hear from people like Carl Russell, who found a solid economic niche for their draft animals and are helpful for anyone who wants to learn about them. I'm Carl Etner. That's it for today's Equal Time. And I'll be back next Monday at 1 o'clock. I'll be talking about the Acorn Fuel Cooperative and a fuel cooperative in Montpelier, along with Chris Steiner, the author of a new book called $20 per Gallon. Artie Levine produced the shows. Don't forget to check EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts of the shows.
Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
The oil market sure behaves differently than most free market economists would lead you to expect. Economists argue that as a finite resource like oil becomes more scarce, the market provides price signals to stimulate a transition away from the resource. Prices go steadily up, so people use the resource more efficiently, and they find substitutes. That's not what we're seeing in the oil market. Oil prices went up to nearly $150 a barrel last year before plunging to under $35 a barrel, and then doubling from that. We seem to be on an oil price roller coaster, which leads to the question, when is the next oil price shock going to hit us? Dave Cohen is an unusually keen observer of the oil markets, and he took a stab at answering that question recently. Cohen writes for ASPO USA, which is a U.S. chapter of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. His analysis takes as its point of departure the proposition that world oil production peaked in 2008. Never again will the world pump and refine as much oil as last year. Before diving into the details of Cohen's answer, it's worth noting that other well-informed observers disagree with the 2008 date for peak oil. The chief economist for the IEA, the International Energy Agency, for example, said in the past few weeks that he expected oil production to peak in about 10 years. Now, this is serious backpedaling from the IEA's position a year or two ago, when they said that oil production would continue increasing into the 2030s. But it's still a marked disagreement with Cohen's analysis. Be that as it may, let's follow Dave Cohen's reasoning to see where it leads, that is, when he thinks the next oil price shock will hit us. Cohen suggests a precise, if somewhat arbitrary, definition of an oil price shock. He says an oil price shock will occur when there's a two-month period in which oil prices stay at or above $110 a barrel. His intuition tells him that such a sustained level of high prices would, and this is where his precision breaks down, such a sustained level of high prices would, quote, once again help bring a structurally unsound world economy to its knees, unquote. Cheery, huh? Well, let's keep going. The reason for the huge drop in oil prices last year, and their present levels at less than half their July 2008 high, is that demand dropped way off as the economy collapsed. For the time being, Cohen says, the world can produce significantly more oil than there's demand for. To calculate when prices might soar over $110 a barrel again, Cohen simply plays the last few years backwards. That is, he says prices will soar when demand once again hits 2007 levels. It was at the very end of 2007 that oil bumped up against that $100 a barrel threshold. What will bring demand back? A return to economic growth. Growth in oil consumption has mostly paralleled GDP growth in the post-World War II years. Using economic projections from the International Energy Agency and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, Cohen calculates that 2011 could see 2007 level oil demand, and therefore the next oil shock. Cohen thinks, however, that the IMF overestimates growth potential. He points out that China and the U.S. together account for about half the world's GDP growth in recent years. The economies of both countries, he believes, are on shakier footing than the IMF is willing to acknowledge. Still, he sees room for leaders to spur short-term growth, even if it's not sustainable. Since Chinese leadership exerts such direct control over their economy, their decisions will have a huge effect on the timing of the next oil shock. Cohen doesn't point to the power that elites in the U.S. have over short-term economic conditions, but decisions by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department have significantly affected the U.S. economy in the past. In other words, look for the next oil price shock when oil demand returns to 2007 levels, and much of the timing of that demand spike is in the hands of Chinese and U.S. leaders. Maybe 2011, maybe a year or two beyond that. Regardless of whether Cohen has the details right, I agree that the world is far from the idealized free market economy, where increasing scarcity of a commodity leads to steady price increases, and that in turn leads people to use less and develop substitutes. We're looking at a volatile cycle of an oil price shock, followed by economic collapse, followed by growth that leads to a new oil price shock, presumably triggering further economic unraveling. So much for the outline of the oil market situation. Maybe next week I'll return to cheerier aspects of the transition from oil dependence to community resilience. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.